Henry Morton Stanley. It is not often that a homeless, penniless boy becomes a member of some of the most distinguished societies in the world, is married in Westminster Abbey, and sits in the English Parliament. Sometime in the year 1841, a child was born in his plain cottage in Denby, Wales. His father, John Rowlands, died a few weeks after his birth, and his mother left him to the care of an aged grandfather, Moses Perry, who died when the boy was about 5. The two uncles who lived in the lower part of the cottage did not want their sister's child, and so boarded him with an old sexton, Richard Price, and his wife Jenny, for half a crown a week, about 62.5 cents in our money. This proving insufficient remuneration for a healthy appetite, a larger price was demanded. The uncles had married and refused to pay. Then the sexton's son, telling the boy he would take him to his Aunt Mary, started with him February 20, 1847, on a long journey. It ended in St. Asaph Union Workhouse, a stone building with big iron gates, an institution for the aged poor and the unwanted children of the parish. The trembling, frightened child of 6 years was now utterly desolate. Tears flowed at the wretched treachery and loneliness. Mr. Stanley wrote later in his autobiography, a volume of absorbing interest published by his wife, "Though 45 years have passed since that dreadful evening, my resentment has not a whit abated. To the aged, it is a house of slow death. To the young, it is a house of torture." 9 long years had passed at the workhouse in which the boy hungered for affection and a home. He was thankful, however, that he'd been taught to read and had received such religious instruction that all through life he strove to do that which was right rather than evil. But the crisis came at last. The schoolmaster was to beat the whole class because nobody seemed to know who had stood on a new table and made dents in it. Young Rowlands, now nearly 15 years old, declared that he did not do it, and when he refused to be punished, a fight ensued, and the master's own blackthorn was used vigorously on himself. The world outside could be no more dreadful than the institution, and the lad and his friend Mose climbed over the garden wall and ran away. But the world outside soon proved a desolate place to a homeless waif. People knew from their garb that they belonged to the workhouse. The first night they slept in a disused lime kiln. The next day, a motherly old lady who was washing gave them food. The second night they slept in the lee of a haystack, and that day reached Denby. Back now in his birthplace, young Rowlands called upon his relatives, but they one and all told him to go back the way he came. "I can do nothing for you," he was told, "and have nothing to give you." Finally, his Aunt Mary gave the lad a new suit of clothes, slipped a gold sovereign, about $5, into his hand, and bade him be a good boy, go to Liverpool, and make haste to get rich. Liverpool, with its big houses and ships, seemed like a new world. After tramping the streets, at last work was obtained in a shop, from 7 in the morning till 9 at night, sweeping, trimming lamps, washing windows, and the like. The only bright spot in the darkness was the assurance of an uncle, "Aye, laddie, thou'lt come out all right in the end. It's a little hard at first, I know, but better times are coming, take my word for it." The boy became ill from the hard work and lost his place. Then followed another month of looking for work. 2 weeks as a butcher's errand boy, carrying meat to the ships at the docks, and then an engagement at $5 a month to sail to New Orleans as a cabin boy on the packet ship Windermere. His uncle and aunt, poor as they were, tried to dissuade him from leaving his own country, but he said, "It's no use, uncle. I must go. There's no chance of doing anything in Liverpool." John Rowlands, unwanted, unloved, was adrift on the ocean. He found a new and bitter experience. He was no cabin boy, but a daily drudge. The brutality of the mate sickened him. The iron belaying pins were freely used on the men. What wonder that after 52 days of ship life, he was glad to be on American soil, even if homeless and penniless, for no money had been given him for his work. And this was the New World. He would take his chances and not go back on the cruel ship. He would see what the city had in store for him in the morning, but tonight he would sleep in the shadow of a pile of cotton bales. Awakening early, he walked down among the commission stores. In front of one, he saw a kindly-faced, middle-aged man reading his morning paper. The lad ventured to ask, "Do you want a boy, sir?" The man addressed thought he did not, but asked what work he could do, if he could read, and what book he had in his pocket. "It is my Bible, a present from our bishop," replied the boy. Asked if he could mark coffee sacks with a brush, he did well, and then was taken by his new friend to a restaurant for breakfast. The boy never forgot that he had superb coffee, sugared waffles, and donuts. Then, after having his hair cut and his clothes brushed, he was led to Mr. James Speak, the proprietor, who hired him upon trial for 1 week at $5. A new life had begun. The tears blinded the boy's eyes as he worked. He inquired about the man who had befriended him, learned that he, at one time a minister, now did business with the planters up the river, and traded through a brother with Havana and other West Indian ports, and that his name was Mr. Stanley. At the end of the week, young Rollins was hired permanently at $25 a week, which seemed a fortune. He paid $10 for board and lodging, and had money left to buy books for his attic room. He no longer was friendless nor lonely. His books were the best company. A month later, Mr. Stanley returned and invited the lad to his home to breakfast. Mrs. Stanley, a fragile and lovely woman, refined and educated, received him most kindly. To the boy, she seemed like an angel. They took the lad to church each Sunday and showed more and more interest in him. Mr. Speak increased his salary to $30 a month. Mr. Stanley called at his humble boarding house and took breakfast with him, an honor that made him thankful and happy. He also bought Shakespeare, Irving, Goldsmith, Cowper, and other authors for him, and often took him home. But changes were coming. Mr. Speak died. The firm passed into other hands, and the lad lost his position. Then Mrs. Stanley, whom he reverenced and loved, also died, telling him to be a good boy. God bless you. As Mr. Stanley was absent, her body was taken to St. Louis at his request. Again the lad searched 2 weeks for work. He sawed wood and did odd jobs for private families. Mr. Stanley had returned to New Orleans, so the boy worked his passage down the river and finally found him. Mr. Stanley was overjoyed to see one who had done all in his power for his dying wife. He folded him in his arms while the boy broke down and sobbed. He had already made up his mind to educate one whom he felt God had put into his care. Finally he said, "As you are wholly unclaimed, without a parent, relation, or sponsor, I promise to take you for my son and fit you for a mercantile career, and in future you are to bear my name, Henry Stanley." He dipped his hands in water and made the sign of the cross on Henry's forehead, telling him to bear his new name worthily. The golden period of my life began from that supreme moment. "I began to see a new beauty in everything," said young Stanley years afterward. "The men seemed pleasanter, the women more gracious, the atmosphere more balmy. As we walked the streets together, many a citizen must have guessed by my glowing face and shining eyes that I was brimful of joy." New clothes in abundance were provided. Henry traveled with his father on his business trips, studied the best books, and learned constantly from the superior mind of his adopted parent. For 2 years, life seemed a dream, too beautiful to be true. He was taught the highest ideals and responded with the love and trust of his ardent nature. In September 1860, Mr. Stanley was called to Havana by the illness of his brother, and Henry was to stay for a time with an acquaintance. The parting was a sad one, and it proved to be forever. Mr. Stanley soon died, and the youth was again adrift. The Civil War had begun. Men were enlisting, some from patriotism, some from love of adventure, and young Stanley joined the Confederate ranks because his Southern friends had enlisted. But he soon learned all the horrors of war. He was at the dreadful 2 days' Battle of Shiloh when the Union forces lost in killed, wounded, and missing over 13,000 men, and the Confederates about the same. On the second day of the battle, Stanley, with others, was taken prisoner and sent to Camp Douglas on the outskirts of Chicago. This, like other prison pens where thousands of men were gathered, became a place of disease and death. Soon he was compelled to go to the hospital at Harper's Ferry, and June 22, 1862, he was discharged, penniless and a wreck in health. During the next 4 months, he supported himself as best he could. Now he worked in the fields and harvesting, and then on an oyster schooner. His only true friend dead, he longed to return to England. The new world seemed to have brought him about as much sadness as the old. In November 1862, when he was 21, he reached Denby in Wales and sought his mother's house. He was poorly dressed, poor in health and poor in purse, but he longed for a mother's love. He says in his journal, "I was told that I was a disgrace to them in the eyes of their neighbors, and they desired me to leave as speedily as possible." He never sought his relatives again. When he had become famous and prosperous years afterward, he was just to the claim of blood and gave practical help, says his wife, but he never again asked for their affection. He returned to America and entered the merchant service, sailing to the West Indies, Spain, and Italy. In August 1864, he enlisted in the United States Navy and served as ship's writer. He reported the taking by the Union forces of Fort Fisher, North Carolina, and the papers were glad to welcome his vivid articles. During 1865, he visited Denver, Omaha, Salt Lake City, and the Indians, and probably paid his way by newspaper correspondence. The next year, with a friend, he went to Asia, but they were robbed by the Turkmens and the journey came to naught. In 1867, when he was nearly 26, his real work seems to have begun. He was made special correspondent of the Missouri Democrat, St. Louis, to write up northwestern Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska, and to join General Hancock's expedition against unfriendly Indians. He also wrote for the New York Herald, Tribune, Times, Chicago Republican, Cincinnati Commercial, and others. Nearly 30 years later, these letters to the newspapers were made into the first of 2 volumes, My Early Travels and Adventures in America and Asia. This same year, 1868, he went to New York, and he says, "By a spasm of courage, I asked for Mr. Bennett, editor of the New York Herald, whom he had never seen." Stanley wished to go with the British expedition against King Theodore of Abyssinia, and for this end made arrangements to write for the Herald. Through great enterprise and energy, he succeeded in giving the Herald the first news of the overthrow of the king. On October 16, 1869, a telegram came to Stanley from James Gordon Bennett, Jr., then in Paris. The whole English-speaking world had been asking what had become of David Livingstone, the great medical missionary and explorer of Central Africa. He had given his life to the Dark Continent. He had buried his wife in the savage land. His children were in England, and he, now an old man, was alone, and it was reported that he was dead. Aid had been sent by England, but he never received it. Letters and packages had been stolen by the Arab slave dealers, who feared that he would arouse the people to put an end to their horrible traffic. Mr. Bennett's instructions were laconic. "Find Livingstone," he said. "What is in the power of human nature to do, I will do," replied the brave young traveler. He reached the island of Zanzibar off the coast of Africa, January 6, 1871. No word had been received in Europe from Livingston since May of 1869. In a little more than 2 months, the expedition was ready. 3 white men, 31 freemen of Zanzibar as escort, 153 porters, 27 pack animals, 2 riding horses, hundreds of pounds of brass wire, many thousand yards of cloth, white and colored, to barter for food and service, his boat, medicine, tools, all weighing about 6 tons. For nearly 11 months, through swamps and jungles, often ill with fever, in the midst of hostile tribes or thieving Arabs, the caravans made their tedious way. The roads were usually a mere footpath. The rivers had to be waded with water up to their necks, or trees felled and a bridge constructed with pack saddles and thick layers of grass. They often crept on their hands through the noisome jungles. Hippopotami, alligators, and crocodiles were in abundance. Insects of almost every kind, white ants, centipedes, beetles, and the tsetse fly, were numerous and nearly crazed the animals. The 2 horses soon died, and several of the donkeys. Their bones were picked clean by hyenas. Many of the men became ill, and Stanley nursed them, and many deserted. Both of the white men died. The little dog, Omar, which Stanley had brought from Bombay and of which he was very fond, also died. Once, when well nigh discouraged, Stanley wrote in his journal, "No living man shall stop me. Only death can prevent me. But death, not even this. I shall not die. I will not die. I cannot die. Something tells me I shall find him." When they reached Ujiji, November 10, 1871, a great crowd came out to meet them. Soon a voice said, "Good morning, sir." Stanley, astonished, said, "Who are you?" "I am Susie, the servant of Dr. Livingston." "Run and tell the doctor I'm coming." Soon a gray-haired, tired-looking man appeared. "Dr. Livingston, I presume?" "Yes," he said with a cordial smile, lifting his cap. "I thank God, doctor, that I have been permitted to see you." "I feel thankful that I'm here to welcome you," was the reply. The long-looked-for, long-prayed-for hour had come at last. For 4 months, these 2 white men lived happily together. They sailed 300 miles around the north shore of Lake Tanganyika and then journeyed east to Unyanyembe. Here Livingston completed his journals and letters to be sent back to Europe, as he would not return till he had made further explorations on the sources of the Nile. They parted sadly, March 14, 1872, and Stanley arrived in Zanzibar 54 days later. With great difficulty, he had forded rivers, swinging ropes across from tree to tree on opposite banks. The precious Livingston journals carried on the heads of men up to their necks in water. Stanley was received with open arms in Europe on his return from his perilous journey. He spoke before 3,000 at the meeting of the geographical section of the British Association, many of them distinguished persons, including the ex-emperor and empress of the French. Lord Granville at the Foreign Office sent him from Queen Victoria her thanks with a gold snuff box set with diamonds, and later she received him and talked with him. Even his relatives had awakened to the fact that the boy from the St. Asaph workhouse had become famous, and sent affectionate requests for money, which he could not refuse. Livingston had died 8 months after they parted, at Alala, near Lake Benguiolo, May 4, 1873. After salting and drying his body in the sun for 2 weeks, it was borne on the shoulders of his servants 1,500 miles to the ocean. On April 18, 1874, Livingston was buried in Westminster Abbey. Among the bearers were Stanley and a 16-year-old colored boy, Jacob Wainwright, whom Stanley had sent to the missionary from Zanzibar. He was with Livingston when he died and faithfully stayed with his body. Stanley wrote in his journal, "Dear Livingston, another sacrifice to Africa. His mission, however, must not be allowed to cease. Others must go forward and fill the gap. May I be selected to succeed him in opening up Africa to the shining light of Christianity." The London Daily Telegraph and the New York Herald agreed to send Stanley on his new mission through the Dark Continent. With 356 chosen men, three of them white, who died on the way, and large amounts of cloth, beads, and food, 8 tons in all, they left Zanzibar November 11, 1874, taking somewhat the same route as before. On March 8, a portion of the company set sail on Lake Victoria Nyanza in a cedar boat 40 feet long, which Stanley had brought in sections from England. At Uganda, they met the Emperor Mutesa, who governed 3 million people. Mutesa wished to learn of the Christian religion, and Stanley told him the story of Christ. Mutesa asked for pastors and teachers to be sent to him, and soon the Christian Missionary Society in England raised $70,000 for the work, and the mission was established. 25 years later, the people of Uganda had built for themselves 372 churches with nearly 100,000 communicants. But many of the people were far different from Mutesa. They came in fury with their canoes and spears ready for battle, and were only subdued by Stanley's explosive bullets, which sunk their boats and their occupants. Once, when the cannibals pressed close upon him with 54 canoes, the men with broad ivory bracelets on their arms and parrot's feathers on their heads, and launched their spears at the strangers, they were cut down by Stanley's rifles, their canoes set adrift, and their huts burned. For nearly 3 years, this heroic march continued through swamp and wilderness amid wild beasts and savages. When they reached what is now called Stanley Falls, they were 22 days in getting past the Seven Cataracts. After more than 7,000 miles of travel, they arrived at Boma, August 9, 1877. 3 days later, they gazed upon the Atlantic Ocean. Then Stanley took his devoted remnant by way of the Cape of Good Hope to Zanzibar and restored them to their friends. From this journey resulted the 2 volumes, Through the Dark Continent, which has had a very great sale. Stanley had explored Africa as no other man had done. It must now be opened up to civilization and to stop the dreadful slave trade by the Arabs. He spoke in all the large cities of England, showing the great possibilities for trade and urging them to build railroads and commercial stations. As England did not take up the work, the Belgians, under King Leopold, were anxious to do so, and for 5.5 years, from January 1879 to June of 1884, Stanley gave himself heartily to this great work, described in his book, The Congo and the Founding of Its Free State. Stanley again visited Africa in 1885 at the request of England to rescue Emin Pasha. The noble General Gordon had been sent to the Sudan the previous year by the British government to assist Egypt in withdrawing her forces that could not hold out longer against the Mahdi. He was killed and his men massacred at Khartoum. Emin, one of the governors, had escaped with his forces to the savage tribes and wrote despairingly to Europe for help. Stanley, with a large force of men, started at the Congo and traveled over 6,000 miles through the interior. It was a terrible march. A great number of his men died from starvation and disease. Stanley was often ill from fever. Finally, April 18, 1888, Emin was found and his forces rescued. After this journey, Stanley's In Darkest Africa was published and translated into French, German, Italian, Spanish, and Dutch. In English, it has had a sale of over 150,000 copies. Stanley was now 49, famous the world over. Thousands upon thousands had heard him lecture or had read his books. He had suffered much from illness, but with wonderful willpower, courage, energy, and great faith in a guiding providence, He had won fame. Now he was to have the blessing of a happy union and a much-longed-for home. On July 12, 1890, he was married in Westminster Abbey to Dorothy Tennant, a handsome woman who had also made a name for herself in art, especially by her pictures of the London street boys. Cambridge, Oxford, and Edinburgh universities gave him honorary degrees. The University of Halle had made him Doctor of Philosophy in 1879. The Geographical Societies of London, Paris, Italy, Sweden, Antwerp, and other cities made him an honorary member and sent gold medals. The United States Congress passed a unanimous vote of thanks for his great work. He received the much-prized honor of knighthood in 1899. In October of that year, Stanley, accompanied by his wife, came again to America and traveled over the states and Canada in a special Pullman car named the Henry M. Stanley. His lectures were crowded. Great receptions were given in his honor. I remember meeting him at an elegant home in New York City, a man of few words, self-possessed, with fine head and quiet dignity. While on this visit in America, he took his wife to New Orleans and walked down the street where over 30 years before, homeless and hungry, he had slept in the shadow of the cotton bales. In 1895, Stanley was elected to Parliament for North Lambeth. He seemed not to care for the honor and did not find much pleasure in the work, but his wife was gratified, especially as she feared he might return to Africa, even though he had been, as he said, racked by over 300 fevers. After 5 years, Stanley was glad to retire. After living in London for 8 years and longing for the open air, he purchased in 1898 Furze Hill in Surrey, about 30 miles from London, a large and beautiful estate. Here he was very happy. He enlarged the rooms, built new walks and bridges, planned a small farm, and made it an ideal home. In April 1903, his left side became paralyzed. For nearly a year, he lay helpless as a child, patient and courageous. In the late autumn, he was able to walk a few steps, but on the anniversary of his first attack, he was stricken with pleurisy, and the end came soon. On the night of May 9th, his mind wandered, and he said, "I have done all my work. Oh, I want to be free. I want to go into the woods to be free." Towards morning, moving his hand upon that of his wife and looking up into her face, he said, "I want to go home." Then came the end. His body was carried to Westminster Abbey, and after the funeral service was read, he was buried in the village churchyard near his home.